beautiful Colorado River in Nevada, and we have Jim Mars with us. Jim, good to see you again.
Hey, Jerry, it's nice to be with you again. We've done some programs before.
Yes, we have, and I appreciate you letting me sit down here in your book signing deal. We may have to stop a couple of times to sign some books. Speaking of books, I understand that you have a few copies left of Crossfire. I thought that was out of print.
Well, it kind of is. I've discovered a few here and there, and so I'm grabbing them up. Actually, I may even have plans to reissue it in an updated version, but I'm not sure when that's going to happen.
Is there someone that may be listening to us or checking us out on the internet that could contact you to get a Crossfire book? Is there a way to do that?
Yes,
we couldn't find it in a bookstore.
We have a few available at my website, jimmars.com, and that's Mars with two R's, J-I-M, Jim, M-A-R-R-S.com. And we'll have some available there as long as they last, but apparently, as you say, it's out of print, and when they're gone, it looks like they're probably going to be gone.
Now, we want to talk about a couple of things with you, Jim, but I wanted to... First of all, we have a link to your website, too, so people can just click right over there and find it as well to order that book. Because it was a masterpiece, and you've had quite a success of that, but you've done quite a few books since then. And I know you have one coming up that's not ready to be released yet, about 9/11, correct?
That's correct. In fact, I just had a call with the publisher, HarperCollins, and they're trying to rush it into print. They said they're that excited about it. It's everything that we needed to know about 9/11, but really haven't been told by the mass media.
Can you give me a little preview about what might be in that book?
Well,
without giving anything away.
No, I think I can give something away. 9/11, it's interesting that even at the time they compared 9/11 to the attack on Pearl Harbor. And I want to tell you, it's a very apropos comparison, but not for the reason most people think. They think, oh, it was a big sneak attack. Well, what we now know about Pearl Harbor is that a handful of people at the highest levels of Washington, Roosevelt, George Marshall, they knew that Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked, and they allowed it to happen to further their own political aims, which at that time was to get a fully united and mobilized American public into World War II. 9/11, the evidence points squarely to the fact there is so much foreknowledge, and there was all this information that has now come out during the past year about information flowing into the CIA and into the FBI, and it was all going to the top. They knew that this was going to happen, and yet it was allowed to happen, or it did happen, and they've used that as an excuse to push several agendas.
And, of course, one of the agendas they pushed is a homeland defense, and you and I feel about the same way about that, I think.
That's exactly right. You know, the only other time in world history that I remember that they had a head of homeland security was Heinrich Himmler in Hitler's Germany, and it is kind of worrisome because, frankly, I don't think that we have to give up all our freedoms in order to protect them.
No, it seems like to me that everyone who did 9/11 won.
Exactly. Whoever was behind 9/11, and of course we're being told it was Osama bin Laden, but there's really been no real proof of that. Whoever was behind it, if their objective was to curtail freedom in the United States, then they won.
You know, this week the Colin Powell spoke before the United Nations and laid out the so-called proof, and it looks like we're marching toward war in Iraq. Any time, and I thought you had a great quote yesterday here in your speech about what John Kennedy said about that.
Yes, John Kennedy back in the early 60s made it very plain. He said that America will never start a war. And I think that's something that, this was something that bothered me, by the way, all through the Cold War. The Russians publicly, before the world, vowed that they would never be the first to use nuclear weapons. And I'm thinking, well, if the United States would vow that we'll never initiate the use of nuclear weapons, then you've got a standoff, and the chances of that happening are lessened. But the United States would never make that promise.
And the thing that's scary now, Jim, is that this administration's leaked more than once to the press, the Washington Post and other papers, you know, that they may consider a first strike nuke capability.
I know it. And where
it's scary as hell to me.
Well, what's scary as hell to me is they're talking about doing this in the Middle East, which is a powder keg. I've been to the Middle East, and I guarantee you, you have so many national conflicts and tribal and religious and family and feuds and racial things that go back for centuries that you're going to set off a nuclear bomb in the middle of that. I mean, it's just insane.
Now, let's talk about rule by secrecy. You lay out some pretty interesting things in this book from HarperCollins, and it's, as usual, a great seller for you because, you know, I might as well confess I'm a big fan of you because you're one of the last of the great journalists, in my opinion. You really get out there and research and report regardless of where, you know, the blame falls.
Well, thank you. I certainly appreciate that. And I will say that what's interesting me on Rule by Secrecy is that when they put it out as soft cover, they had a little blurb at the top that said, "The Underground Bestseller." And, you know, it actually hit the New York Times bestseller list, extended list. It hadn't gotten in the top 10, but I think it was number 18 or something like that. And I asked them, I said, "Why did you put underground bestseller?" And they said, "Well, because, you know, you don't get any publicity. The New York Times hasn't reviewed it. The Washington Post hasn't reviewed it. All the major media, they ignore it, act like it's not happening. And yet it has hit the New York Times bestseller list. And that's because people who read it say, wow, look at this information. And they give it to their families and their relatives and their co-workers and everything, and they read it and they go, wow, and they give it to their co-workers. And so it really has done very, very well for a book that has been totally ignored by the corporate-run media.
In fact, you know, that's more or less my opinion about the problems today. The corporate conglomerates really control everything, and for some reason reporters just don't ask questions anymore. Now, I don't know if they get away of telling them not to, or they just don't put it in. What's your theory about that? I think you probably think it's the information flow itself.
No, it's very specific. Within the past few months, I was on a nationally known talk show. And before I could be on the talk show, I had to have a conference call with the producer. And the producer, in no uncertain terms, told me I was not to talk about George Bush. I was not to talk about the current administration. I was not to talk about 9/11 or any political thing.
Did you ask him what the hell you could talk about?
Yeah, I said, well, what can I talk about? But, you know, it really bothers me, especially coming from the mass media myself. I was trained, educated as a journalist, and I worked for a number of newspapers, including big major newspapers. And the idea that somebody's going to tell me, here's what you can talk about, here's what you can't talk about. I mean, that to me is the that's just an anathema to freedom of speech and democracy. And yet that's where we are today in America.
It certainly seems that way. And you wonder why some of these media icons in the field of news would put up with that. But I guess it's because of money, huh?
Absolutely. I know for a fact that several people I know who have been offered big contracts, particularly in radio talk show, big money, nice cushy position, the kind of thing that most people give the right arm for, but I know at least one who turned it down because in these contracts it says that the corporation retains editorial control.
That's right, and I remember when I got out of journalism school, that was one thing you didn't allow anybody to have.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
No, it's kind of status quo.
Well, this is what really bothers me, Jerry, is that I guess I'm just getting old and kind of a curmudgeon or something, but I'm a child of the 40s and 50s and 60s, and I can remember when this truly was a free country.
And
I know the difference.
You can remember, so can I. What's happening here, Jim? You know, Rule by Secrecy is a pretty compelling book in many ways, and things that we talked about many years ago and kind of laughed about seem to be really coming true, like the Illuminati and the whole thing seems to be, they seem to have more power than we ever gave them credit for.
That's true, and of course, in Rule by Secrecy, what I try to point out is that even based on their own statements and their own public material, they are pushing for what they call globalization, which you also hear it referred to as the New World Order, and what it is one world government, one world military, one world communication, one world financial system. And I was trying to warn a little bit about that and bring some of that information to the public. And of course, since 9/11, it has been just almost a stampede towards this. And I think people need to stop and ask themselves the most important question of all. Let's assume that, number one, philosophically, I don't have any particular gripe with the idea of one world global government or whatever, because after all, we are one world and we are one people. But we are being pushed into this by secrecy and deceit by a handful of people. And it begs the question, if they succeed and if we have a one world government that has total control over every person on this planet, what's our guarantee that some new Hitler-like tyrant won't gain control of that power? And not only do we not have that guarantee, but, you know, actually, we're not even supposed to be talking about this.
Yeah, you're unpatriotic if you bring that up. And does this man want his book signed? No, not yet. Okay, fine. That'd be fine. You have a question for Jim Morris?
Thank you. Actually, I didn't, but let me quickly, Mr. Morris, thank you so much for Rule by Secrecy, and an alternative title I thought of was Rule by Deception, but I think what you did was great, and I really enjoyed your talk yesterday. I'm so thankful that you are bringing out all these hidden things that are going on behind the scenes, and that you took the effort to investigate the murder of JFK. And I believe, statement more than anything, I believe that if we don't begin as a nation to consider more fully the direction we're going and the people who killed President Kennedy, if we let that slip past, we're going to continue to let these other things slip past, like what happened at Waco, and what happened in Oklahoma City, and what happened at 9/11. And there's so much overwhelming evidence today that the government of the United States had prior knowledge to 9/11, was probably complicit in it, and I say, damn well, if we don't draw the line somewhere, we're not going to have a chance in the future, because they're getting more and more ruthless. And I don't just say that off the cuff, because anybody from the World War II era knows that more than likely Pearl Harbor was staged. And if Pearl Harbor was staged, God damn it, we're in deep shit, because it could very well have been that 9/11 was staged. And I hate to say it, but if it was, we've got a whole lot of trouble in front of us.
What's your name, sir?
Mike Marino.
Where are you from, Mike?
California.
Thanks, Mike. He has a new book coming out about 9/11 and discusses all the things you were discussing.
That's exactly right. And let me add this for those that might be listening that would go, why our government would never do anything like that. Let me mention Operation Northwoods. Okay, this was a program that was never supposed to see the light of day, but suddenly was made public here just a year or two ago. And the documents are in the National Archives. They're absolutely, these are government documents. And what it is in the early 60s, after the Bay of Pigs failure, they turned the war against Castro over to the Pentagon. Planners within the Pentagon came up with Operation Northwoods, and this was a plan to hijack airplanes, set off bombs within the United States, kill people, and blame it on Castro, so that we would get the American people, you know, rallied around, and we'd go try to invade Cuba again. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff signed off on this program. It was John Kennedy who said, wait a minute, this is not what this country's all about, and apparently put a stop to it. So you better believe that, yes, they are fully capable of doing something like this.
You know, Jim, you brought up something interesting in your books, and what we talked about last night, Abraham Lincoln and John Kennedy have something in common. They were both shot, and they both created a different kind of denomination for money.
That's exactly right. In all of United States history, the only two presidents who have had the courage to try to issue interest-free money, in other words, money that we don't have to pay interest to international bankers, was Abraham Lincoln when he printed the greenbacks, and John F. Kennedy. Oops, excuse me.
And John F. Kennedy had what was that? That was a U.S. Reserve note, or no? Just a U.S. note, right?
I'm gonna start over on this.
Okay.
the two presidents that in this country's history that issued interest-free money, in other words, money that we don't have to pay interest to the international bankers, was Abraham Lincoln, who issued his greenbacks, and John F. Kennedy, who in June of 1963 issued United States notes backed by silver that were issued through the Treasury Department, which, by the way, is constitutional money. Because the Constitution clearly says that Congress shall have the power to coin and regulate money. And, of course, they abdicated that in 1913 when they allowed the private banking system of the Federal Reserve to come into existence. The Federal Reserve gets approval for more debt for the United States. Then they turn around and print money and then loan the money to the United States at interest. And when when they talk about retiring the national debt, this is the money that we have to pay every year, probably a quarter to a half of the entire United States budget, pays towards interest. Abraham Lincoln said the creation of money is one of the most creative powers that government has. And yet we have given that over to private banks. And when I say private banks, the Federal Reserve System is neither federal nor does it have any reserve. It is 12 regional banks that are in turn owned by private banks, which are in turn owned by private citizens, a good portion of which are not even Americans.
Now, you deal in your book, Rule by Secrecy, about this subject quite a bit, don't you?
I go into it at some length, including just the whole secrets of money. For instance, when you go and deposit $100 in the bank, that's an asset to the bank. But the bank doesn't keep it. It turns around and loans it out to somebody else at interest. So now it's a debit, okay? So it's both, your $100 is both an asset and a debit. And, that cancels each other out. So your $100 actually doesn't count for anything. But what counts is the 20% interest they charge. Because when the money's paid back to the bank, they got $20 that they didn't have before. And they haven't done a damn thing for it. They just got it. And when you come get to say, I want my money back, do you get $120? No, you only get your $100 back. So somebody's made $20 off of nothing.
We're talking with Jim Mars. The name of the book is Rule by Secrecy. We're at the Flamingo in Laughlin on the Gold River, the Colorado River. And, of course, you have a question for Jim Mars? No, okay. Jim, I have a question for you, and that is on this 9/11 book that you've come out. Did you have any problems getting somebody to publish that? I know you're under contract with HarperCollins.
Well, yes, and not really, but I did. There was a tardy factor, and this really bothered me because I had this information within days of the 9/11 attacks. Within a month, I had written it up. In fact, there was a big article on my website entitled War on Terrorism, Fact or Fiction. And I used, so in November of 2001, I sent that to my agent, and I said, see if they don't want to use this as the basis for a book. Nobody really wanted to mess with it because we were all in this, got to go get somebody, you know. Nobody wanted to stand up and question the stampede at the time. Then, as it comes into 2002, as it gets to be late spring and all the revelations start coming out about how the FBI had all this foreknowledge, the CIA had knowledge coming in, it was all flowing up to the top, nothing was done about it, all of a sudden their interest peaked, and they go, well, wait a minute, this is pretty interesting, let's do something with this. So I quickly put the whole thing together, expanded it, got them a manuscript by September, and here it is February, and
still not out,
but they're talking about putting it on a fast track. They said they might move it up to August now. of course, one of the things. I don't see anything sinister in this. This is just what happens when you deal with a giant corporation, you know.
Itself was so much more sinister, the idea of talking about 9/11 and the government being complicit in it. I wonder, Mr. Mars, are you familiar with Barry Zwicker from Canada?
Who now?
Barry Zwicker has a TV program in Canada, and you're probably familiar with Mike Rupert.
Yes.
Well, I got a videotape by Mike Rupert where he was in a panel discussion, and along in the package came this tape from Barry Zwicker. And I didn't look at it for a while because I didn't recognize the name, but he's a very courageous journalist in Canada who has compiled six programs that he produced in Canada that were each about 6 or 7 minutes long, and he condensed it into or put it together in a one for one tape, and in that 39 minutes or so, six segments, he points out all the typical questions about why were no jets scrambled when it happened? Why are we led to believe that Andy Card told him after the second plane hit that this horrific thing had happened and that that was the first time it happened? And he brings out a number of other things, including Operation Northwoods, including all the number of books like The Crime of Patriots and a number of other books, the BCCI scandal. And what comes to my mind is that we're in deep, deep trouble. There's no question about the fact that we got a problem. We know it if you look at Rodney Stitch or Bo Greitz or any of a number of other people. The question now is, what are the people going to do? Are we going to just sit back and let this thing happen?
You know, that's one of the problems that's interesting to me, and I'll ask Jim about this, is there doesn't seem to be anybody standing up in opposition. What happened to the loyal opposition here? There doesn't seem to be any.
Well, I guess I'm it.
Congratulations.
Because I've been raising Cain ever since the day it happened. And
thinking more in terms of political figures. They all sing the same song.
Well, you know, we had one courageous senator who was against the war in Iraq and who wanted an independent investigation of 9/11 and who was up for re-election, and his seat was pivotal to who, if the Republicans are going to control the Senate, Paul Wellstone, and oh, gee, his plane crashed.
You know, not any questions were really raised about that, and I'm not saying that it wasn't an accident, but there's certainly a lot of suspicion there.
Well, you have plausible deniability because planes do crash. But let me, it was mentioned that why we're not fighter interceptors scrambled on 9/11. See, the collective memory of the American public must be about 5 minutes. Let's think back when Payne Stewart, the golfer, and they were up in a jet, and the oxygen equipment malfunctioned, and they were overcome, and that jet flew and flew and flew, and I mean, it wasn't but minutes before there's interceptors all over them, and then trailed them all across the United States, ready to shoot them down if they were going to crash in a populated area. But they ran out of fuel, they were over kind of an open area, and the thing crashed. The point is that a golfer can have a malfunction in his airplane, and the jet interceptors are there immediately, and yet 9/11, they got three planes hijacked that they know is hijacked and off course, and they can't get planes in the air. Something is really wrong with that whole picture.
Yeah, it seems to me like it was at least, give them the benefit of the doubt, it must have been 35 minutes or so, that obviously there was something wrong. Some people say as much as 45 minutes.
Well, you know what, though? Let me tell you an interesting story, and to try to take the other side. What I discovered in what's in my new book is really pretty astounding. The National Reconnaissance Office, the very morning of 9/11, had scheduled an exercise, a drill, and the scenario was that a plane had crashed into their building, okay? And, of course, in this scenario, I think it was like an accident or whatever, but nevertheless, this scenario for that morning with a top-secret government agency, which is in charge with interpreting all our satellite imagery and everything, had scheduled an exercise. So the argument might be made that, like when President Bush is informed, hey, a plane's crashed into the building, he probably knew about this NRO exercise and may indeed have just said, oh, well, that's the exercise. And it may explain the tardiness in response. May. I think there's other mitigating circumstances.
Well, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. And
yeah.
Let's say that happened. How about the plane flying all over Washington before it decided the Pentagon should be the target?
That's right. In fact, that steep spiraling dive, lowering out to light pole level and plowing into the Pentagon is probably one of the biggest farces of that whole thing. I was an aviation aerospace writer for years, police reporter. I've covered more than my fair share of plane crashes, and you don't have a plane of that size crashing into a building, I don't care how well fortified, and just crumbling up and burning up and disappearing. I mean, that's just the most ludicrous story I've ever heard. The hole in the Pentagon is not wide enough to accommodate the wings of a 757. And that hole was not there when the plane hit. The hole was there when the building collapsed after there was fire and explosion inside. So there's something really, really strange and unexplained going on about the Pentagon attack.
Do you have a conclusion in your book about that?
Well, no conclusion other than I can't believe that a huge 757 loaded with fuel piled in there. One other example, the hole that was punched in the third wall, the third section, corridor section of the Pentagon, they said this was caused by the nose cone of the airplane. Well, anybody knows anything about these airplanes knows that this is made out of aluminum, and that's probably the weakest, most vulnerable part of the plane. It is not going to punch through a halide light block wall. You know, it's going to crumple up, and it's going to, you know. So the stories we've been told is just garbage. And, of course, it's not the first time. I know Lee Harvey Oswald did it all by himself. We were told there's light at the end of the tunnel in Vietnam. We were told I am not a crook. You know, we've been told all this stuff, and it turns out to be totally bogus. My only thing is, let's not wait 30 and 40 years. Let's find out right now what's going on and what the truth is so that we can start dealing with it as a true, free, and democratic people.
You're listening to Jim Mars. I'm Jerry Pippin. We're broadcasting from the beautiful Flamingo Hotel on the Colorado River in Laughlin, Nevada. Anyone here have a question for Jim Mars?
Yeah, this morning there was some discussion over the news of some suspected terrorist attacks or expected terrorist attacks if we go in and attack Iraq. What, do you have any comment about that?
It's pretty much of a coincidence. Colin Powell makes his speech an hour later. All of a sudden, the leaks start. Hey, there may be a terrorist attack if we go to Iraq.
Well, how many terrorist attack warnings have we had? It's almost on a weekly basis, you know. And they've even got their little color code. This week it's red, next week it's yellow, you know, like that. What does this do? All this does is ratchet up the fear factor. It makes everybody afraid, and everybody doesn't want to speak up. Nobody wants to say, wait a minute, what about this legislation that you're passing that's unconstitutional? You know, then nobody wants to say anything about that. And that is part of the agenda. Keep everybody fearful. Here's the thing. I don't fear terrorists because terrorists just want to kill you. Okay? And if you know that, then you can fight them, or you can run away from them, or you can take another plane. You can do something. What I fear are would-be tyrants and dictators, because they want your freedom. And they'll do it by any means possible, no matter how devious, no matter how deceitful. And I think that this is what we see in play right now.
In addition, they want to do it over a long haul. They don't want to do it next week. They're prepared to take 3, 4, 5 years down the line to achieve their goals. And I wonder, Mr. Mars, what would you say is the temperature that it takes to melt steel?
Oh, in excess of 2,000 degrees, up more closer to 3,000 degrees.
What temperature does jet fuel burn at? It doesn't burn at a lot.
Bad. Yeah, JP4 and stuff runs, burns at about 300 degrees, 800 degrees, something like that.
So how do we have the probability or the possibility that the fuel from these planes caused the girders to melt sufficiently to bring the buildings down? That's number one. Number two, if you were going to give your life, Mr. Mars, to attack some country in the world, and you and your buddies were going to die, you knew you're going to die, what would you destroy in that country? If you had the choice, wouldn't you choose the biggest symbol of that nation, wouldn't you? What would you, out there in the audience, what would you destroy? If you were going to attack the United States of America, and you were prepared to die when you did it, what would you hit?
What's your point? You don't think it would be the World Trade Center?
Well, if I were going to die, and I was prepared to die, I certainly wouldn't pick that as my chief target. No, no way.
What's your target?
The Capitol building. Not the White House, the Capitol building.
I kind of figured to hit IRS headquarters, and then you'd have most of the people on your side.
You got a good point there. You're listening to Jim Mars. I'm Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting to Flamingo. We have about 4 or 5 minutes left, so let's... you have a question for Jim?
Yeah, I do. Jim, one of the most interesting aspects of the 9/11 sort of conspiracy aspect was the executive stand-down order. I mean, the Gordon Dowson article in The Observer in Britain pinpointed a lot of sort of interesting anomalies, shall we say. His sources were fairly impeccable, but the executive stand-down order, which prevented the jets being intercepted, was to me the most damning part of it. Have you got a comment on that?
Yes, what I see there are parallels to the John F. Kennedy assassination. Anybody could have killed the president. Anybody can attack America. But who has the power to withdraw and withhold and bring down the normal security? I think that points us in the direction of the deceit that may be behind
these events.
Was there any specific, I mean, when he says, when he references an executive stand-down order, did he actually have a reference? Like, is there a sort of documentation that can back up that claim, or is that just an assumption?
I'm not sure if there's going to be hard documentation, but just the sheer fact that it took them more than 35 minutes to launch any interceptor shows that there was some sort of a serious breakdown in the defense system. As a child of the 50s, I can remember during the Cold War, we were told repeatedly and assured that not one Russian bomber could come across the Arctic Circle without our planes and NORAD having interceptors in the air, you know, within minutes, and they were never even going to reach the continental United States. Well, hey, are we that much behind where we were in 1950? You know, come on.
You got a good point there. I want to get your names here and where you're from.
Tim Coleman.
Tim Palmer, from where?
Tim Coleman. I live in the Bay Area.
Bay Area, and where are you from?
Bob Spordone from California.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot for taking part in the show. We only got a couple of minutes left. Jim, this book will be out in August.
Hopefully.
That's the plan.
Yeah.
What are you working on now?
Well, actually, I'm here at the UFO Congress, and I've come up with a really interesting smoking gun in the UFO thing.
Good, let's hear about that.
Okay. In the 1897 edition, April 19th, 1897 edition of the Dallas Morning News, is a story about a silver cigar-shaped object that crashed in a little place called Aurora, Texas. The article said that debris was scattered all around, and the pilot, whose remains were badly disfigured, but enough was picked up to show that he was not an inhabitant of this world. Now, this was published in the Dallas Morning News in April of 1897. It was also published in the Fort Worth newspaper, because I looked it up in the microfilm.
That's before airplanes were around.
7 years before the Wright brothers ever flew. Now, the problem was, up until recently, I had only seen copies of the article. So the debunker's argument is that, well, this was just a planted hoax story, you know, trying to draw attention to the area. A couple of weeks ago, I managed to get hold of the entire front page of the Dallas Morning News, April the 19th, 1897, 7 years before the Wright brothers flew, and there are 16 stories on that front page, and every single one of them concerned this object flying through the skies of North Texas. One said it was shot straight up, so much for a meteor. Another said it landed and they talked to the inhabitants, so much for a natural phenomenon. It's absolutely incredible, and there it is in full documentation. It was published over 100 years ago, and obviously something was flying in the skies of Texas long before the first recorded heavier-than-air flight.
Well, Jim Mars, you have a tape about that, don't you? Or a video or something that people could get? Can they get that through your website, too?
Yes, I just did a documentary on that called Aurora, the UFO Crash of 1897, and it's available on my website. And here, I'm going to give you a copy of this front page from the Dallas News. I will read you one of these little things. I thought it was really funny because people always ask me, well, if these UFOs are real, if they come from somewhere else, why don't they just land and say, hey, you know, here we are, let's be friends? Well, in that same newspaper, let me read you from Granbury, Texas. Newt Grisham last night at 9:10 o'clock, while drilling the Riddle rifles, discovered that mysterious flying genie of which we have heard so much. Newt is a very warsome young man, being a populist, but he could not stand the sight of the air machine, and so he ordered the company to open fire on the object, which they did, and the whole town was soon aroused. What is that, Bubba? I don't know, but let's shoot at it.
Yeah, right. Hey, it's in the Texas tradition, even back to 97, huh?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So, yeah, I think we can see why they don't land. We'd probably just start shooting at them.
Jim Mars, it's always a pleasure. Look forward. We'll run across to you again soon, I hope.
Great, Jerry. It's always a pleasure to be with you, and we'll do this again sometime.
Okay, thank you very much.